Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It is Friday, January 11, 2013. 11 years ago today, George W. Bush's people opened the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In our in-depth interview, part two today, we talk with Andy Worthington, the international expert journalist, on our barbaric detention facility in Cuba.
Never come with a warning. A revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture. They're telling you that you will never see the horror. Spend it all today and we will build you tomorrow.
Don't worry about the torture. It's a feature film now called Zero Dark 30. Send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas. The there's a prophetic line in there from Michael Franti and Spearhead. 10 years from now, is anybody going to bother? I'm sorry to report the passive acceptance of America's leaders and citizens of the ongoing blight on our alleged reputation for liberty and the rule of law, because Guantanamo was constructed for the purpose of evading constitutional protections and American law, and it in so many ways has succeeded. And I put up a Facebook post when I put out yesterday's News and Comment podcast on Facebook. I said, that this is a dark day for America, January 11th, and that most Americans don't seem to care. I hope you do. And I've gotten very few responses so far. People more interested in posting pictures of their cats or their breakfast. And that silence, that yawning effect that you get from most people when you talk about Guantanamo, I find very painful. And in our interview with Andy Worthington, he gives us a quick rundown on the current population there, 166. And just off the top, 55 of them have been cleared for release and languish there. And with the passivity of the White House, Obama has given up on closing Guantanamo. Oh, he mentions it in passing. He did in the campaign. The Congress has further tied his hands by saying you can't let him out, except under very limited circumstances. They cannot come to the United States, either freed or to continue being held without trial or charge indefinitely. And the courts have sealed that door shut. Habeas corpus petitions are routinely dismissed, saying, well, the government knows best. Jay Johnson, J-E-H is his first name, who just left as the Pentagon counsel, has timidly raised the question of, well, when will we say these hostilities are over? And what will that mean? Can we continue to hold uncharged individuals at Guantanamo? And here's a real poke in the eye, an op-ed in the January 11 New York Times, under the signature of Georgetown law professor Jennifer Daskal. She used to work for Human Rights Watch and the Justice Department. And she says she's changed her mind. 3 years ago, she was branded a member of the Al-Qaeda 7 because she advocated for the closure of the detention facility. She said, I was indignant. I reacted defensively. I insisted on the legitimacy of my convictions. Now, she says, almost 4 years later, I've changed my mind. And she makes passing reference to the inhumanity, the crimes against humanity, and goes on to say, well, you know, since we're going to hold these people without trying them, some of them, and because Yemen is a war zone, without mentioning why, she is accepting that Guantanamo is a reality and should stay open. She says Guantanamo 2013 is a far cry from Guantanamo in 2002. So the majority of detainees now live in communal facilities where they can eat, pray, and exercise together. What bullshit? These are people who have no idea if they will ever leave the prison compound at Guantanamo or the walls of some other detention facility. And she rationalizes that, someday we're going to declare an end to this phony war on terror. And then we'll, figure it out. She says the political reality is that the closure of Guantanamo is unlikely to happen anytime soon. And if it did, it would do more harm than good. We should instead focus on finding places to transfer those cleared to leave the facility. And more important, on defining the end to the war. I find that intellectually empty and quite insulting. In the in-depth interview that I referred to, it's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. The first segment is an interview with Nick Turse. And his new book is a very difficult account of the war crimes during the Vietnam era. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, and that is a quote from a commander driven by the manic desire to roll up a huge body count of dead Vietnamese, whether they were civilians or armed combatants, for PR purposes, and on the mistaken notion that North Vietnam would at some point cave just because of the massive numbers of dead Vietnamese people. And there is a free book offer in the interview for a Vietnam veteran. So I encourage all to listen to the full interview at pbc.com. Here's an excerpt as Nick Turse describes one of the scenes of a massacre and other clear war crimes that occurred, sometimes ordered by the higher-ups with winks and nods, other times driven by the desire of troops to please their leaders. And in the second part of the clip, you'll hear Nick Turse say that beyond a few courts martial and the My Lai case, that few were held accountable. Those who were didn't serve much time, and never were the leaders, political or military, held accountable for the clear war crimes that occurred in Vietnam. Give a listen.
Well, there's one veteran that I pay special attention to in the book. He comes up a number of times in Kill Anything That Moves, who he really affected my life. His name was Jamie Henry. And before the war, he was a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district, but he was drafted and became a medic. And he was a very good medic. He saved a lot of American lives. But he was really shocked by what he saw in Vietnam. On his first day in the field, he watched the point man, the lead man in his patrol, molested a young girl that they came across. And he thought to himself, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place in his unit. A young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner who was thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier. And he kept seeing these things. But the first time that he spoke up about this brutality, his life was threatened by fellow unit members, and his friends in the unit told him, look, you got to keep your mouth shut. You'll get a bullet in the back during a firefight, and it'll look, like he was killed by the enemy and nobody be the wiser. So, Jamie kept his mouth shut, but he kept his eyes open and continued to take note of all these things that were going on around him, including on the day in early February 1968 when his commanding officer issued an order to kill anything that moves. And he watched his fellow members of his unit gun down 20 women and children in a My Lai-style massacre. Well, the high command was never indicted in any way for this. These cases fell apart one way or another. If they did go to court-martial, juries, military juries were very reticent about convicting. They're their fellow troops. And a lot of times investigations were sabotaged or they were quashed at higher levels. There were a lot of generals who dismissed charges, even though there was very strong cases that in any other circumstance would have been brought to trial. The entire military establishment was really against, as you might imagine, putting the war on trial in any way. And then this extended down to individual troops. It's very rare that you see convictions, and those who are convicted, it's very rare that they served any kind of long sentences for this. It just wasn't done.
That's writer Nick Turse, who spent 10 years investigating files, going to Vietnam, interviewing veterans, Vietnamese survivors of the carnage that we leveled on that country. It's a powerful book, and I encourage you to read it. Nick Turse currently works as an editor for TomDispatch.com, Tom Engelhardt's website. And as such, he has done a lot of important coverage on the mess in Iraq and Afghanistan. And there are many parallels, as we discuss toward the end of my conversation with Nick. And today, Hamid Karzai, the puppet leader from Afghanistan, made the trip to the White House. And in the news conference afterward, President Obama announced that, and get this, because of the gains made by Afghan security forces, the United States will be able to accelerate the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Now, I certainly support this decision. It's way too late. We have lost hundreds of American troops, including to insider attacks, during this futile period as Obama put in this phony surge in Afghanistan. But the idea that, like we were able to Vietnamize the war in Vietnam, which was a PR lie, the idea that the illiterate, drug-addled, and disloyal ranks of the Afghan police force and army are able to take over their own security is simply fatuous. Obama made it clear that he contemplated leaving relatively few troops in Afghanistan after the mission ends in 2014. Now, that also is good news. And as I've commented over the last week or so, we've seen these trial balloons floated. Certainly for Karzai's consumption, and maybe to grease the confirmation of Chuck Hagel as the new defense secretary. We had never heard the option of zero troops in Afghanistan after 2014, and Obama is going to use the same stipulation that got him out of Iraq, even though he was trying desperately to keep some troops there, and that is we need a status of forces agreement that gives immunity to American troops. Karzai now says that with this decision for the U.S. to leave, that he can get a status of forces agreement from whoever he considers his government in Afghanistan. Now, two notions that are important. One is that the trade-off is that Karzai will get complete control, it appears, over the prison called Parwan that's on the complex of the Bagram Air Force Base near Kabul. And apparently this is going to happen in the next few weeks. Certainly in the meantime, they've transferred out the black site prisoners who Obama won't even identify. Who knows where they have been parked. And Karzai also floated this. He said he's hoping the United States will supply the Afghan army with the latest military hardware, including tanks and fighter planes. Are you ready for the Afghan Air Force? Oh, boy. I mean, these are sick jokes that grease our exit, so I guess I have to accept them. In Quetta, Pakistan yesterday, 115 people killed in a couple of different incidents, one at a pool hall where 81 died. And the carnage continues. Our response will be more drone strikes, more innocent civilians killed. It doesn't appear we had anything to do with those attacks, and we'll wait and see if we actually do find out. In the Persian Gulf, an incident involving an American nuclear-powered attack submarine and a fishing trawler. sketchy details so far, but it seems like the top of the submarine's periscope was cut off as a fishing trawler, apparently accidentally, just buzzed right over this submarine. They're saying the trawler captain may not even have realized that he hit it, and the trawler itself apparently didn't suffer any damage. If it was an Iranian trawler, this could be one of those pretexts for a wider conflict. Next week, I'm going to bring you the audio from a TV interview I did this past week with the brother of a Palestinian filmmaker whose documentary received an Oscar nomination yesterday. It's a powerful film called Five Broken Cameras. And it tells the story of this small town called Bilin, which is just inside the border on the West Bank, and how over the last 10 years, Israel first sent surveyors saying we need to build a security barrier, and ultimately they grabbed 60% of the area around this town, and all of it is inside the West Bank borders of Palestine. And their tactics are barbaric. I'm sorry to say they're Nazi-like. The brutal efforts of the Israeli forces are depicted by this Be the Media guy named Imad Bernat. One of the things they show is that in retaliation to the Israeli development of a massive settlement that now has a population of 50,000 Israelis on land that used to be their fields and olive groves, the Palestinians attempted to build their own settlements in the disputed territory. They were quickly routed by Israeli troops. But today we learn of another wildcat outpost on the West Bank. Scores of Palestinian activists erected tents on Friday in a hotly contested piece of Israeli-occupied West Bank territory known as E1. It's just east of Jerusalem. The protest comes 6 weeks after Israel announced it was moving forward with plans of thousands of settlement homes in this E1 area. Israeli military authorities arrived on Friday and handed the protesters notices warning them that they were illegally trespassing on their own land and that they had to leave. Well, I applaud them. And one of the big questions that Iyad Bernat, the brother of the filmmaker, answered for me is that his town of Bilin and the neighboring town Nilin has never, ever launched a rocket attack either toward or into Israeli territory. They use peaceful, Gandhi-like, nonviolent tactics, and the Israeli forces respond with maximum militant tactics. Here in the United States, the debate over addressing gun violence continues. And New York Times is reporting today that Joe Biden has tipped his hand that the idea of an assault weapons ban as the signature element of a package is being played down. Now, on a practical level, I know how right-wing the Democrats in the Senate are and how even right-wing and pro-gun the Republicans in the Senate are. It's what they call a heavy lift. But this is where Obama fails to provide leadership. And to say, look, I'm the president. I was just reelected. I'm in my second term. And I'm determined to do something to reduce the carnage from guns in this country. He's not leading. They're counting votes and saying the votes aren't there and they're giving up. Now, there are some meaningful efforts that they're going to undertake. A national gun registry. We're going to hear that that's a gun-grabbing tactic from the NRA and its allies. Expanded background checks. Well, show me the language. We'll see if that's meaningful. Yesterday, I reported in the early accounts of this school shooting in Kern County near Bakersfield, the town of Taft. We have more details now. It was a 16-year-old student with a shotgun, and apparently he'd been bullied by the man or the fellow student that he killed. He had 20 rounds of ammunition in his pocket. He was using a shotgun. not an assault weapon or an assault-like weapon or a gun that could be fired repeatedly without being reloaded. Now, the interesting thing here that contradicts the idea that the NRA advances, that we need armed guards in our schools, is that after he killed his fellow student, who he has accused of bullying, he was persuaded by a teacher to put the gun down and surrender. Now, we can only guess. I'm not pretending that what I'm about to say is provable. But think about this for yourself. If the teacher had pulled a gun on the student with a double-barreled shotgun, would the student have put his gun down? Maybe. But I think it's more likely that he would have fired that second round, and the teacher would be dead. Interesting commentary in today's San Francisco Chronicle on the op-ed page from Marsha Cohen, a law professor at San Francisco's Hastings College of the Law. And her proposal is for mandatory insurance for gun owners. She says that if there's a well-drafted state law requiring gun owners to show proof of insurance, it'll raise the cost of gun ownership, but the insurance companies will take a closer look at the people they write the coverage for. They will rate the risk of these individuals. They might even do a more thorough background check and a mental health check than the government ever will. They might provide incentives for fingerprint-based trigger locks. So I think it's an interesting idea, and it doesn't require confiscation of anybody's guns. But of course, any move you make is going to be virulently opposed by the gun lobby. Women's groups are pointing out that the Obama cabinet is shaping up to be a boys' club. Only HHS Secretary Sebelius and Homeland Security Secretary Napolitano are the remaining females, and all the replacements being proposed are men. The one post where a woman has resigned is at the Labor Department, where Hilda Solis, a Californian, has said she's had enough. And Congresswoman Barbara Lee, one of my favorite people in the Congress, a true progressive, although she's, like so many, pulled her punches with President Obama as our leader. Barbara Lee says she's available. Not quite. She said that she would seriously consider a cabinet appointment from the Obama White House. And here in California, you know, I've talked many times about my advocacy for life prisoners, those who are sentenced to 7 to life, 15 to life, with the possibility of parole. And one of the things that I have told you on more than one occasion is that the track record of life prisoners who are paroled is nearly spotless. And in the last 20 years, up until yesterday, no life prisoner had reoffended in the murder category, either attempted or otherwise. And that record has been stained by a guy named Dennis Stanworth, and he has a real checkered history. He was convicted for killing two girls way back in 1966. And he was sentenced to death. And when the death penalty was suspended in 1974 by the U.S. Supreme Court, his sentence was downgraded to life with the possibility of parole because there was no law on the books for LWOP, life without the possibility of parole. He was then paroled in the early 90s and lived a quiet life. The only thing on record was a seatbelt violation in 2011. But yesterday, he called the cops, turned himself in, reported that he had killed his mom. We don't have the details yet. His mother had been moved out of their home and into a senior facility. She didn't like it, and she moved in with a friend. And it's possible it was some sort of a mercy killing. It's also possible that Stanworth wanted to go back to prison. When he was first sentenced to death, he said, "Please kill me." One of those crazy people who invited capital punishment. So that record, I think, doesn't fully undermine the fact that 99% of life prisoners released do not reoffend. Snakes on a Plane? I never saw that movie. The trailer was enough to convince me that it was a waste of time. But a Qantas Airways plane flying from Australia's northeastern city of Cairns to Papua New Guinea flew the whole way, 2 hours, with a 10-foot python clinging to the wing of the aircraft. The passengers could see it out the window. It actually managed to hang on until the plane landed in Port Moresby, but the creature expired. And finally today, the national rollout of the controversial film Zero Dark Thirty starts, and I'm actually going to hold my nose and go watch it this weekend, and I'll report my reaction to it here on our News and Comment next week. But as we wrap up this episode, I'd like you to listen to Gary Chu, our official Peter B. Collins film reviewer, and here is his take on Kathryn Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty.
It came to me as I left the screening of Zero Dark Thirty the other evening. I had this silly, sudden urge to quickly whisper at two or three people working the concession stand that the bad guy gets killed in it. But I thought better of it, and without a word went outside to my car. But as I walked across the lot, I thought to myself, I wonder about the life histories and personal conflicts of the U.S. personnel depicted in this new film by Kathryn Bigelow, who also did the great The Hurt Locker. What is it that motivates them to such courage and risk? How much of it is for the right stuff, or is it for stuff that isn't? That also ran through my mind part of the time watching this extraordinary movie about the stalking and killing of Osama bin Laden. Otherwise, what we have here is a very well-made motion picture about something quite important to U.S. citizens. It is not a police procedural. However, Zero Dark Thirty is mostly a procedural. And dare I say it, everyone already knows how it comes out at the end. That's not the point, though. The point being, the film allows for common image to be taken in by Americans on how shutting down bin Laden happened, with actors playing the roles of real American personnel, and in some cases it seems characters that are a composite of more than one real person. They are a curious collection, though. Intelligent, educated, argumentative, articulate, obsessive, determined, loyal, obedient, and appreciative of the importance of foul language uttered at just the right moment, especially the character called Maya. All of these traits are essential. By the way, Maya is the lead character and played by Jessica Chastain, and she's the one I'd like to know more about. Hardly a hint is given about Maya's backstory, except for a brief stretch of dinner-out girl talk between her and her buddy agent, Jessica, played by Jennifer Ehle. Unfortunately, their social chat is cut short by the terrorist truck bomb explosion that rocked the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, Pakistan, in 2008. Playing Maya does display the stretch in Chastain's acting talent, though. I've seen her in more than a few films over recent years. Maya could have been easily overplayed. With help from Mark Bowles' script, Chastain, a native Sacramentan, keeps Maya enigmatic, except for occasional measured outbursts of emotion watching her captives being tortured by others, learning a colleague has been blown to bits by a car bomb. The tension felt as the raid to take out bin Laden proceeds, and the nose-diving moment of de-stressation, or distressing, I guess you would say, that begins to take hold of her as the mission is accomplished. Except for Chastain and James Gandolfini, the movie is cast with few familiar faces. They are, however, faces to remember and ones you'll likely see again. By the way, Gandolfini's part is a cameo. He plays what can be inferred is another Californian, named Leon Panetta. License was taken to suggest that Mr. Panetta is a good deal larger than he actually is, though. Accents and rapid dialogue make some of Zero difficult to follow, but unless you're parsing the script for accuracy, what's going on is pretty plain to see. Bigelow's film is significant and plays out as a rather neutral dramatization of an actual event, but this movie didn't move me as much as her Oscar-winning The Hurt Locker. That 2008 work put you inside the several military personnel who also take great risks to do their job for America. On the other hand, Zero Dark Thirty has a quality to it much like another film that, as of yesterday, sits among the Best Picture nominations for movies released in 2012. That film is Lincoln. Seeing either Lincoln or Zero Dark Thirty is an excellent way to get the lay of important territory in American history. But since Zero Dark Thirty seems not to have any spoilers in it, let me toss one out to you that's really in the movie. Now here it is. Just remember, whenever the film is about to get really intense, the 007-ish music is brought up full. I'm Gary Chu, down in the valley.
Thank you, Gary Chu, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins. I'll talk to you again real soon, right here.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.